Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, not coming to you from the studios of KCRW in Santa Monica. Instead, I'm on a special online hookup and I'm at home in Los Angeles. My wife and I are locked down for the moment. Of course, that's because of the restrictions imposed by the coronavirus pandemic. It is inconvenient. We didn't stock up a lot, and we have to order food and other supplies, and it can be a long wait. Sometimes we get what we want, and sometimes we don't. But it's worth it. We don't want to get COVID-19, and we don't want to spread it, which we might do without even knowing. So we'll do what's required in our own interests and in the interests of everybody around us as well. And also, Marcia and I get along. We like each other. So it's not so bad. Anyway, that's where we're going to start this edition of To the Point. The last time we spoke with Professor Philip Alcabes was during the H1N1 outbreak in 2009. That was just over a decade ago. He's director of public health at Hunter College in New York, and he is author of Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to the Avian Flu. Professor, I want to welcome you back. I'm almost sorry I have to.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, but it's sad that it has to be under these circumstances.
Okay, so I'm at home. Where are you?
Also at home. They have canceled in-person classes, so we are teaching remotely.
So what does that mean? How do you teach remotely? How does it work?
Different various online programs. There are quite a number, but it means for me it's very sad because the great appeal of being an educator is being in a classroom with lots of smart young people, and I can be with smart young people, but only by internet. Not the same.
How long do you think this is going to go on, based on your study of epidemics past, that we aren't going to be able to have the human interconnection that is so important?
It's impossible to know. I fear that however long the outbreak goes on, that there will be a disruption to the way we have led our lives that persists much longer. And I think that that's because of a gross mishandling of this outbreak on the part of American authorities.
So what could they have done? When could they have done it?
The news from China, of course, was bad. The news from Italy should have been the red flag that there's a country, actually it was at the beginning just the north of Italy, that was taken by surprise, had no time to prepare, and was faced with a sudden surge of people needing medical care, sometimes hospitalization, ventilation, et cetera. We had time, because that was happening in February. We had time to mount a public health response, and we didn't do it.
It all happens so fast. You say February, and it seems like last year almost that things have developed so quickly. So how do you fault the authorities for not being able to react to something that changes so quickly?
The public health responses to viral, to an outbreak of any kind of pathogen that spreads as rapidly as this does are pretty clear. There's a playbook. What should have happened in the U.S. was a massive effort at testing and contact tracing, tracing of contacts with people who test positive, thereby identifying cases, isolating the cases so that they wouldn't spread the infection further, making treatment, adequate and timely treatment, available to everybody who needed it. And we might have controlled the outbreak as soon as it got here. But that didn't happen, and it didn't happen for a number of reasons. There's an article in this week's New Yorker that details some of the problems, which have to do both, summary is, both incompetence and bureaucratic obstacles that should not have existed, and failures of flexibility, and most of all, failures of leadership. Now, with 3 years of the current administration, we've kind of become accustomed to failures of leadership from the top, but there still needs to be leadership at the institutions that keep the public healthy, and that wasn't happening.
Why not?
Well, I don't choose who the leaders are. I have a view, but I have no inside information.
Which public agencies are you talking about very specifically? Is it the Centers for Disease Control? Is it the Federal Drug Administration?
I have to applaud Anthony Fauci from the National Institutes of Health, who's been brilliant, who really knows what he's doing, and has tried his best to be very clear about what's happening, what we need to prepare for. But as people have been paying attention to the news know, the president has been undermining or negating Fauci's messages. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention should have stepped up. I don't know if their failure was because they've been hindered by the administration or because they didn't have enough competent personnel to do it or because they were embarrassed. They should be embarrassed about the failure of their COVID-19 test. So I don't know. I don't know why the failure occurred in its most granular form, but I know empirically that it occurred. There still aren't very many test kits around. We're still promised. We hear local officials promising every few days that there are going to be more test kits soon, and we keep hearing that. So the public health response has barely happened. We have not created a medical care system that guarantees timely and appropriate care to everybody who's sick. A policy of universal medical availability has been around as a proposal since before the First World War. Over 100 years later, we still don't have that. So we don't know what's going to happen if lots of people get sick. We're not taking the steps needed to prevent lots of people from getting sick. And therefore, to end my answer to your question, there's no way to know how long this is now going to take.
Back to the issue of testing, we don't have enough, clearly. And yet, from time to time, we see that there are drive-by testings in one state or another. We hear that one of the basketball teams is going to be tested, one of the NBA teams, because it's turned out that there has been incidents of COVID-19. How do we determine who gets the tests when there's such a limited number and who doesn't?
I don't know how that's being determined. I know anecdotal stories, and as I think you do too, and listeners no doubt do, that of people trying to get tested and having to jump through all sorts of hoops or being outright turned away because they didn't meet that testing center's criteria for allocating what's obviously a precious commodity. There aren't enough test kits. We don't do it for everybody is what they're saying. So I think a way to summarize that, to generalize that point, is that this event is showing us the weaknesses in the society that we've built, all of the ways that we've failed to put ourselves in a position to take care of everybody. So when everybody's afraid, or almost everybody's afraid, or a lot of people are afraid, of a well-defined threat, we don't have enough tests to be able to identify the people who should be worried and rule it out for the people who don't need to worry. When lots of people are getting sick, we don't have enough hospital beds, enough ICU beds, enough ventilators, and most of all, we don't have a medical financing system that actually allows people to know that they can get care if they're not insured or if they're not documented. And that's a lot of people.
Is this to some extent function of the way our government is structured. We've talked about federal agencies of one kind or another, but public health, as I understand it, is a very localized thing and perhaps needs to be very localized. And of course, we have this structure of 50 states, each of which itself is divided into cities and counties. Is it inevitable then that we're going to have a difficult time getting it all together at the same time?
I've been asking, that's a great question. I've been asking myself the same question. The states are in charge of medicine and health under the Constitution. So it's always been true that the federal government has limited powers around health or medical care. That probably made sense in the 1780s, because if there was a yellow fever, that was the big deal in those days. If there was a yellow fever outbreak in Georgia or South Carolina, probably people in New York weren't so worried about it. But things are different now, and that's really that's the basis of your question, I think, that it doesn't make sense to leave all public health organization up to the states when increasingly public health problems are national or, as in this case, global. And I don't know the answer, but I do think we as a nation have to start asking that question and resolve it.
You talked about incompetence and bureaucracy at the outset. President Trump has taken a lot of heat for allegedly taking apart the effort that was made by the Obama administration to try to set up a structure of some kind after the Ebola events. That was primarily, as I understand it, in the National Security Agency. Is he, to some extent, getting a bad rap? His defenders are saying, well, he didn't really get rid of those agencies. One guy in particular who had served there said, I was there, and that's not what they did. They were just reorganizing and cutting down unneeded staff and so on. Has the president, do you think, taken more criticism than he actually deserves?
Well, I think he deserves a lot of criticism, but in general, his leadership of the country in response to the concerns about coronavirus. But my sense is that this is not a particular area of failure, that it probably would have made little difference to have a pandemic preparedness team at the national security level if it wasn't empowered to take quick national action. And I don't know that that's what that group would have been able to do. So I'm not sure that would have made a big difference. And perhaps if that's the focus of the criticism, perhaps that's not well taken criticism. For me, the criticism is that the leadership has, in the past, American leadership on health crises has taken the form of deferring to the experts, not undermining them or contradicting them. So not only do we have the leader of the country who's not turning to the experts and asking for advice or simply referring people to talk to the head of the CDC, he's actively denying the truth of what they're saying in some cases. And that's bad. It's bad for everybody.
Well, that certainly has been true up until the last couple of days. And what we have seen now is that the president says, wait a minute, we do have a problem. And you might think that he's talking about an entirely different thing than he was just hours ago. So obviously he is switching around according to finally what the evidence actually shows. But let me ask you this. Given that we are fundamentally structured in such a way that quick national action is very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve, what would quick national action look like if we had it?
You can see I'm stymied here. What would it look like? First of all, there would be the political leadership would defer to the public health leadership. It's the Surgeon General, the director of CDC, the director of the NIH, who should be responding and providing information. The information would be clear and consistent. That has not been the case. It would be easily available. And it would not focus solely on future threat. One of the shapers of this epidemic, of the way anxiety seems to be the leading response on the popular level to this outbreak, is a result of early coverage that focused on how many people were dying. Actually, as more data become available, it's clear that people are infected with coronavirus who never get sick. Most people who get sick don't get very sick. Many people who get very sick still don't die from, may need hospitalization, but don't die. And so the tenor or tone of the coverage was dire from the get-go. And I think good leadership would have said, we need to tell the whole story.
So the better leadership than we've had, you're suggesting, might have been able to exercise some kind of restraint on the media. That's pretty difficult. I've been in the media for a long time, and there is, of course, a tendency, and it has been increased rather than decreased over the years, to go with the most sensational story you possibly can every moment of the time, because it's so competitive.
Sorry, I don't want the media to be restrained by government. I think that's a horrible idea, and I didn't mean to imply that, and I apologize. However, I think that leadership in a crisis means that the people who have the data, which ought to be CDC, Surgeon General, are broadcasting the data so that people have that measured approach to reality, not just what's being transmitted by various media outlets and, let's face it, by social media.
When you say you don't want to see restraint on media, I understand what you're talking about. And of course, as a person in the media, I don't want to see it either. And yet, I find myself feeling that the media ought to be self-restrained. And I suggest, or I think what you're saying is, that if they had more and better information earlier on and leadership that was saying, wait a minute, let's not blow this thing all out of proportion before we go too far, then that would be a kind of restraint that we probably need.
Exactly. And you might remember my saying that in the context of H1N1 in 2009, that I let journalists, and I'm not speaking about social media here, but professional journalists, in my experience, are very good about transmitting the story, the facts that they know, but they only know what's given to them by officials and what they can find by researching. So it's officials' job, in my mind, to work with journalists to make sure that people know what they need to know. And I don't see that that's, other than outside of Tony Fauci, I don't see that that's been happening in a consistent way in America since the start of this scare.
Since we last spoke in 2009, of course, social media has become a very different creature from anything we could have anticipated at that point, I think, unless somebody was really able to see into the future. Your book is called Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics. You indicated a moment ago that anxiety has been a primary response to this. What about fantasy? Where have you seen fantasy?
It often seems to me that when people who are, particularly in social media, are talking about this outbreak, that what they're really talking about is a movie that they saw. Contagion or Outbreak, listeners probably know the names of all of them, that they're not talking about, they don't actually have the facts. They're talking about a movie that's in some way dramatizing fear and is itself a fantasy. So I do have that sense, although I don't have data to document that that's what's happening, but it does often seem to me that many people are responding to a fantasy about what might happen. Social media, even the last big national public health crisis, I guess, was Ebola, late 2014, and it seems even since then that social media is positioned differently. Right now, it seems to me that most people live in a sea of information. And a way that I've been saying that this outbreak, this event, is unprecedented is that it's not the worst disease outbreak ever, and it's not going to be. But we've never had one in which information moves faster than thinking. When you get people's ideas before instantaneously and second by second, or at least minute by minute. But thinking takes longer than that. So before any situation can be examined, assessed, deliberated, and made sense of, there's a welter of information spreading around the globe. And we've never had this situation before.
President Trump, of course, is an official who never wants to hear any bad news. But even officials who are less inclined that way, it seems to me, are going to have a harder time making decisions in a democracy when the situation you describe exists and there's so much information and so much misinformation all flooding together at the same time.
I agree. I don't know how officials will be able to do their job when their job is communicating the reality as it is known in a situation where information about all sorts of pseudo-realities and virtual realities and fantasies is being communicated even faster. I don't know how that will work. It's a problem that has to be addressed, that has to be faced.
Are there cases from the past where the situation was handled well enough that we could learn from it? Has anybody ever coped with one of these things successfully? You talk about fear and fantasy fueling epidemics from the Black Death to the avian flu. That's a lot of history.
Most of your listeners will remember Ebola not that long ago, and that was handled very well. Now, not that many Americans had it, but the information was provided in a very clear way. The then director of Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Frieden, was out in front of the information, made public announcements, made clear what was going to be happening. The Centers for Disease Control instructed state health departments about guidelines, about procedures, so that when cases did happen, people knew what to do, and it was possible to reassure the public that what needed to be done was really being done. So there's one example. Maybe some people will reject that because it wasn't that big of a deal. There were only a handful of cases in the U.S. I would say that there have always been, and this is what I wrote about in the book, the responses to outbreaks have often been, perhaps always been, driven by fears and anxieties. Sociologists sometimes talk about us as the modern contemporary society as a risk society. We think a lot about what might go wrong. But what we really are in America is a selective risk society. We get very, very concerned about certain possibilities of disease or injury or death, and not so concerned about others. We're much, much more concerned these days about coronavirus than we are about car crashes or gun fatalities. So which you don't read about in the news very much. So what makes us, it's actually the question that led me to write the book in 2009, what makes us focus on certain things, certain diseases as threats to American life as we know it? And that really makes one ask about, well, what are we really worried about? What anxieties do we bring to this before there's even a germ, a pathogen, to get us worried?
We're going to be talking in a moment about whether this is analogous in some ways to what's happening with climate change. But I'm very interested. You said that this isn't the worst it's going to be. What is your greatest fear?
I suppose it would probably be sharks, but I don't swim where there are sharks. Climate change, probably.
As we've heard, COVID-19 is hardly the first pandemic, and we are going to talk about that a bit later. Once again, we've been talking with Philip Acabes of Hunter College, a student of public health and author of Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to the Avian Flu. Professor, it's been wonderful to have you, and thank you so much. I hope we don't have to do it again too soon.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
As we've heard, COVID-19 is hardly the first pandemic, and it is not the first existential crisis facing the modern world. There is, as we've already heard, climate change. It's just happening more slowly. We'll hear in a moment about how each crisis can teach us about the other. After a very quick break, this is To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To the Point. We're turning now from one existential crisis to yet another, from the coronavirus epidemic to climate change. Gernot Wagner is a climate economist at New York University. He's author of Climate Shock, an ironic title since we have known for decades that global warming is causing climate change. It's not a shock anymore. Welcome to the Point.
Thank you.
You've been quoted as saying that the coronavirus pandemic is climate change at warp speed. What do you mean by that?
It is happening within days and weeks, frankly. Things are going rather quickly these days. Climate change takes decades, centuries, and in many ways, it's been taking me, a decade more than that, trying to figure out how to explain to people that even though it takes so long, it is a crucial topic. Well, we don't have problems doing that with COVID-19.
So what other similarities do you see when you say that this is climate change at warp speed?
I guess the biggest one is it is all about compound growth, exponential growth. Right, in the best of times, frankly, that's the reason why Warren Buffett advises us to put our money in an index fund and not look back. If you do so at an early age, sooner rather than later, you too can be a millionaire. Climate change, of course, is the negative side of this. Right, levels today, temperatures today are bad, but they're nothing compared to what could, would, will happen unless we act. Well, COVID-19, the exact same thing. It is not really about levels literally today, at least not quite yet in most places in this country. It is about growth rates. It's about the fact that cases grow 33% or so on average per day. That means you start with 100 cases today at 33%, you're at 30,000 within 3 weeks. That is a massive, massive change. And same with climate change, of course, but just on a much, much longer timescale.
So what are the consequences then of knowing this but not taking appropriate action?
Well, in both cases, COVID-19, of course, especially now, consequences are death, right? Unfortunately, if one doesn't take these compound growth rates seriously enough, and frankly just looks outside the window today and says, well, look, things aren't all that bad. Right, so far in New York City, some like 10 people died in New York from COVID-19. That's nothing. I mean, it's not zero, of course, but there's something like 200 New Yorkers dying every day for all sorts of reasons, right? 10 isn't all that bad. Well, that's not what we are worried about, right? What we are worried about is tens of thousands of cases per day, overwhelming hospitals, and so on and so forth. That's the reason why we are, in this case, trying to flatten the curve for climate change, trying to bend the curve of emissions, and must do so rather quickly in order to avoid this all-powerful compound growth.
Now, of course, instead of bending the curve, we have a situation where emissions are rising.
Exactly, right? Now, they've been rising year after year. People like me, worried about climate change, have been jumping down about this year after year, saying we must act now. This is going to come back to haunt us sooner rather than later. And yes, there are plenty of reasons to be worried about climate impacts hitting home today already. But, and that's the big problem with climate change, the real problems happens decades, centuries hence. COVID-19, back to the current crisis, here it's days and weeks.
So here we are trying to contain the COVID-19 crisis at the moment, and people are asked to stay in their homes. You, I know, are in your home in New York. We can hear your children in the background, which is wonderfully appropriate, I think, because we're talking about what might happen to future generations. What's the climate change equivalent of staying in your house in order not to have the coronavirus spread?
Well, frankly, in some interesting ways, there are, some of my colleagues who have spent their lives worried about climate change, sometimes now pointing to the positive effects of, oh, look, people aren't flying quite as much right now. True, yes, of course, right? More people are trying to figure out the unmute button on their teleconference now. That's great. Now, on the other hand, of course, this current COVID-19 crisis is certainly not how we want to be cutting emissions, right? It's the exact opposite of how we want to do this. If anything, I would say we should be much, much more worried about how to take lessons from climate change and figure out how they can be helpful now in acting on COVID-19 than the other way around. That said, yes, of course, what this is now showing is that massive behavioral changes, massive changes, are possible. They truly are. As long as the crisis itself hits home, yes, we react. We as a society can react quickly. But of course, there's a big, big difference here between climate and COVID-19.
In a democracy, what's the role of government?
Well, for this, in this case, and frankly for both COVID-19 and climate, the role of government is pretty clear. It's precisely our leaders, politicians, government, that needs to act and in many ways nudge, guide, force us to do things that we wouldn't otherwise be doing. That's another big parallel between climate and COVID-19. Externalities, spillover effects, right? I, as a healthy 40-year-old, may not be the one most affected by COVID-19, but yes, me being out there, in fact, helps spread the disease and might kill others. That's an externality, right? That's not something I'm affected from. My behavior is not something I'm affected from directly, necessarily. I might get sick too, of course, but it's the spillovers. The spillovers to others in society that we ought to worry about, and that point to the need for government to step in and tell us not to go outside right about now.
In knowing how to nudge and guide or even force change, how important to government is it to pay attention to science?
Well, that's where it starts, right? Or ought to start, at least. And of course, not to be too political, but that's of course one of the major problems. And frankly, one of the reasons we are where we are in this country now, right? If you look at some other countries who basically acted, which acted much, much sooner. Now, you know, Hong Kong, Singapore, of course, aren't exactly democracies, but even a country like South Korea, which is basically not quite emerging yet from this crisis, but yes, took the science seriously, acted early on. All of China apparently yesterday had one new case of COVID-19. The entire country of China, a billion people. Yes, of course, they've been in lockdown for a month, but they're emerging from that, having acted quickly, relatively quickly, and frankly, taking the science, the epidemiology in this case, much, much more seriously than we apparently have.
With regard to climate change, we have the fossil fuel industry, which for decades has known about the problem, but fought against any effort to try to deal with it and, in fact, encouraged denial. Is there anything comparable to that with regard to the coronavirus and pandemics in general?
I mean, sure there is, right? There always is. There's always a case you can point to, oh, this particular airline that didn't want to do something earlier on, was lobbying hard not to have its flights shut down, and frankly, fortunately, in this case, lost. But I would say the same applies here to vested interests lobbying as to climate. Given how fast things are moving with COVID-19, frankly, there wasn't even all that much time to do that. Now, that said, yes, of course, right? We see that, right? We see President Macron of France walking outside on a Friday evening, going to the theater, demonstrating that everything is okay. On Tuesday, 4 days later, his culture minister falls sick with COVID-19, and the entire country shuts down 5 days later. Now, you know, how much of any of that was due to lobbying by vested interests, those with a stake, with a lot of stake here, making sure that we don't overreact in presumably the language they would use, I don't know. What I do know is, of course, that the first place you want to look for how politicians will react is probably not the science, the epidemiology. It's probably precisely what do stakeholders think? What do vested interests think? What do those who are most economically hurt by this think? And as usual, of course, it's not the poor, the vulnerable, who are first in line to receive the benefits. It's those with biggest connections who would be first in line to, for example, be bailed out now from this current crisis.
When draconian action is necessary, it's very easy to raise the problem of overreaction or to perhaps even exaggerate the problem of overreaction. How do you overcome that psychological fact of life?
So it's pretty clear, right? So as an economist thinking about trade-offs, that of course, right, shutting down an economy does in fact involve costs, real costs. Now, I would argue strongly that at the end of the day, compound growth does in fact dwarf all. I have a very hard time thinking through a benefit-cost analysis here that does not include the strong, strong conclusion that we should have shut down a long time ago. Shut down we must. That said, yes, of course, and this frankly is one of the big psychological problems here, the sense of overreaction is very real. right? If we succeed here in containing, which of course is no longer really possible, but mitigating the worst when it comes to COVID-19, it will all seem like an overreaction after the fact, right? Very few people die, relatively speaking. Few people contract the disease, relatively speaking. And then after the fact, it seems like, wait, we did all of this for this? For something that turned out not to be all that bad? Hospitals didn't run out of ventilators. Nursing homes didn't have to shut down completely, and so on and so forth. The sense of overreaction may well be something we'll be faced with sooner rather than later, and in many ways already are. That said, I would say that may well point to a real success in the sense that, yes, we have been able to contain, mitigate this virus early on. It did not lead to the kind of nightmare predictions that are floating around now. And of course, that goes back to this old saying, right? What point is there in venturing in prediction if all you do then is sit around and wait for it to become true, right? All we need to do in many ways is to realize that, yes, there are bad things that could happen. So let's do everything possible to avoid that.
That's just a fascinating idea I hadn't thought of before, that the more successful you are, the more likely you are to be criticized in the future when people are looking back out of hindsight. Are there examples of that? Are there times that that's happened in history where actions have been taken successfully avoiding crises, and then the people who took the action have been criticized in the aftermath?
That's a great question. So frankly, from the climate side of things, we're certainly not there yet, right? There is nothing really we can point to where, oh, look, fortunately, it wasn't quite that bad. Of course, there are plenty of environmental success stories too, right? For example, the ozone hole over the Arctic, right? Stratospheric ozone hole, where we did successfully with the Montreal Protocol, basically outlaw some, not all, of the offending substances, created some other problems in the process, but where we as a global community came together, found a solution, signed a treaty instituting that solution. And yes, some of the predictions basically didn't come true, right? The sort of nightmare scenarios of all of us suddenly experiencing what those in Australia and the southern tip of Latin America experienced during the height of the ozone hole, none of that came true. Another quick example in sort of the late 1800s in New York City, one of the bigger public health problems was essentially drowning in horse manure, the fear of drowning in horse manure, because, well, if you look at sort of predictions of more and more New Yorkers wanting horse carriages, what do you do with all the manure? There's only so much of the stuff you can ship over to New Jersey. Now, turns out we solved that one. Right around the same time when, you know, urban planners, public health academics were trying to figure out what to do to solve this particular crisis, we invented a new technology called the car that essentially solved that problem for us. Created lots and lots of other problems in the process, of course, right? Climate change only being one of them. But yes, of course, there are also lots of benefits. And frankly, that too is an analogy here, right? That new technology, in a sense, is the vaccination that may well come, hopefully, sooner rather than later, right? Still months, 12, 18 or so months from now, but still, that's for COVID-19. For climate, of course, it's new low-carbon, high-efficiency technologies. Some of them have already been invented. We simply need to deploy them. Some may not have even been invented yet.
That is just a great example. I have never heard before that the automobile was invented in order to get rid of the horse manure. That's a new one on me.
Well, it actually, that's the point, right? It wasn't invented in order to. It was in many ways sort of happenstance that, you know, Henry Ford, at the same time that New Yorkers were worried about drowning in horse manure, right? Somewhere in a garage in Detroit, somebody was tinkering with this new technology. But yes, right? Back to the point about predictions not coming true, those predictions of New Yorkers, you know, suddenly drowning in horse manure certainly didn't come true.
But nobody in Holland ever got mad at the government in the aftermath of building the dikes.
For example, right? Now, you know, in many ways, you know, that's been around for so long, right? Centuries at this point, that in this case, that that may well, there may well be a chicken and the egg problem here, right? It's different to essentially say, wait, we would have drowned if we had not acted. In this case, well, it was the creation of the dikes that enabled people to live in certain places in the first place.
Back to the analogy between the coronavirus and climate change. Here we are sheltering in place. So you are in your loft in New York with your family. I am sitting in my home in Los Angeles, broadcasting to a station in Santa Monica, or not broadcasting, but I'm linked by electronics because it's a time when I'm not supposed to go out of my house. Are there comparable things that need to be done with regard to climate change that we ought to be doing now?
Well, frankly, the use of technology to avoid further emissions is certainly at the core of climate change, climate policy. It's actually fascinating to me now, looking at some of the COVID-19 implications for climate and vice versa. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, right? The scientists coming together, telling us how bad it is and what to do. They are now, this April, having their very first meeting of 300 or so lead authors electronically. Instead of hopping on a plane, they're going to jump on a phone call, on a video conference. Now, frankly, virtual, exactly. Who knows how long that will last, right? There is sort of two ways I can see that go. One is, right, all the canceled meetings that would have happened this summer, right, instead of the professional association that would have met in Cleveland this summer, saved a bunch of money this year because they held it virtually or canceled it altogether. So next year, instead of going to Cleveland, they're flying all the way to Barcelona because why not, right? More money left over, and finally we are emerging from this social distancing period. Now let's party. That, of course, would lead to, right, an increase in emissions. The opposite, of course, may well be true too, right? We suddenly all realize that video conferencing isn't all that bad. Maybe we could, in fact, use it more. But frankly, I just don't know. I can't see how we, you know, in this situation now, predict what might happen, what would happen once we emerge from this current crisis. Because yes, it could go both ways. Now, the trick, of course, right, in many ways, it takes guidance. It takes government to come in and say, well, let's internalize the externality here more so than we had done in the past. Let's price the risk more appropriately than we had done in the past, which may well lead to a rethinking of the way we lead our lives more broadly and may, hopefully, actually have positive effects on climate as well.
So again, then, as a climate economist, and you've been beating the drum about climate change for a long, long time, are you optimistic then that we might actually learn something from the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, it's too late for pessimism. So yes, I guess I am. Now, frankly, just to be clear, even now, or maybe, you know, especially now, and even as someone worried about climate change all his life, not to put this too glibly, but I couldn't care less about where emissions go because of COVID-19 right about now. Right? I care about the people are dying right now because of COVID-19. So in many ways, the name of the game right about now is applying some of the knowledge that we may have gained by looking at climate that's applicable here and try to, in fact, apply it to, you know, frankly, saving lives now with COVID-19, right? For climate, it's the poor, the vulnerable, the young who suffer the most. For COVID-19, it's the poor, the vulnerable, the elderly who suffer the most. But other than that, there are, in fact, many, many parallels. Growth rates, externalities, the need for government to step in certainly applies to both topics.
Gernot de Wagner at New York University, author of Climate Shock. Once again, a wonderfully ironic title. It's really instructive to talk with you, and thank you so very much for being on To the Point.
Thank you.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineers, Kat Yor and Chuck Prevetary. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. We also are at @ToThePoint_KCRW, and you can tweet me @WarrenAlney1. As I said at the outset, we won't let social distancing prevent us from podcasting. We'll be back as usual. Hope all goes well with you in the meantime. Join us again.